Hello and welcome to Access Utah. I'm your host, Brian Earl, and I have with me on the line from a couple of different locations. We have first Jeanette Warner, who is the owner of Wildland Nursery in Joseph, Utah, and then also from High Country Gardens in Santa Fe, New Mexico, David Salmon. And today we're going to talk about penstemons. Penstemons are one of those flowers that at least up until the last quarter century haven't been known as well in their home state of Utah and the Intermountain West as they have been in Europe. And this Friday and Saturday at the Sevier County Fairgrounds is the fourth annual Penstemon Festival, and that's been being put on by the Utah Native Plant Society. Jeanette, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Please tell me about the Utah Native Plant Society's Penstemon Festival.
Well, like you said, this is the fourth annual Penstemon Festival. The first couple of years was put on by Merrill Johnson, a Great Basin Native. Last year, the Native Plant Society decided to kind of take it on under their umbrella and going to move it around the state each year to different locations. And we just are lucky enough to have it here this year.
Well, I wasn't even aware that there was a Penstemon Festival, and one of your guests that will be there is David Salmon of High Country Gardens in Santa Fe, New Mexico. David, thanks for joining us on the program.
You're welcome, Brian. A pleasure to be joining you this morning.
So what will you be talking about? Of course, native plants will be one of those topics, but what will you focus on?
Well, specifically, I'm going to be talking about the genus Penstemon, the native beard tongues.
Well, then let's dive right into that. Now, one of my favorite flowers happens to be penstemons, and I've ordered some from High Country Gardens and local growers as well, have them in my yard, and when I'm taking care of them the way they should be taken care of, they're just flourishing and doing really well. And I've got some that are just in blossom right now, and it's wonderful to see the yellow, the reds, the blues, the purples. What makes penstemon a plant that people should consider growing?
Well, they are a huge genus of native wildflowers, and in fact, over 300 species and countless subspecies and varieties and hybrids. I'm going to be focusing on growing the non-hybridized, generally the wildflower type of penstemons in the garden. So there are some definite techniques about successful penstemon culture that differs a bit from, say, more traditional old world flowers like Shasta daisies and Oriental poppies and daylilies and plants like that.
Well, now I understand that Utah is probably, there are more penstemons and native species in Utah than most anywhere else.
Yes, well, the penstemon are a North American native. In fact, I believe out of the 300, there is only one species found outside of North America, and that's a rather nondescript species from Western Asia. And in the Western United States, where we find so many of these beautiful penstemon, Utah is really the epicenter of penstemon diversity, I think in part because there are so many different isolated mountain ranges in Utah that has encouraged the genus to evolve into many different species.
So how many are there in Utah right now?
Oh, gosh. If I gave a number, it would just be a wild guess, but I would think that at least 50 wouldn't be too far out of the ballpark.
And between the both of you, I'm sure you see which ones are easier to grow than others. So I just kind of wanted up front talk about some of the different ones that, I mean, there are some that are common and others that are beautiful, but I'm not sure I'd want to grow because I've got a little bit too much clay in my soil.
That's a very important consideration when growing any wildflower is being sure that you match your soil to the likes of the plant. And penstemon in general are very picky about having a well-drained soil. They don't like a rich, water-retentive soil that we prepare for our traditional perennial beds and vegetable gardens, they do like drainage.
Yeah, the Palmer Penstemons that I first put in, just they did not like where they were growing in my yard. The firecracker penstemons, though, boy, they've taken off. And I think is it a pine leaf penstemon that's a yellow?
Yes, there are a couple of cultivars of yellow pine leaf penstemon, Mersey Yellow, which actually came back to this country from its discovery in England. And there's another, my favorite is called Magdalena Sunshine, which was found in habitat down in the Magdalena Mountains in south central New Mexico.
Now, that's one thing that, as I've read your magazine and or your catalog and have gotten to know the company a little bit better, you seem to enjoy being able to find those cultivars that are just kind of hidden. You haven't seen a different, I don't know if you would call it a sport like you would in an apple, but just a new one that just kind of pops up.
Well, that's always the fun of gardening is the discovery of new plants. And for me, as both a horticulturist and a collector since I've been a little kid, I enjoy amassing and planting as many new species and cultivars in my gardens as I can, because that really is, I think, one of the important aspects that keeps people interested in ornamental gardening.
So how old were you when you first started getting into gardening?
I was about 15 years old.
Okay, and what interested you at that point?
Well, I was a devoted insect collector at that point, and specializing in butterflies and moths were my primary interest, that and beetles. And at one point, I got very interested in raising caterpillars to their adult butterfly or moth stage so that I could get unblemished specimens for my collection. So to do so, I had to learn about the larval or the caterpillar's food plants, and be able to identify them and harvest the leaves to feed my caterpillars.
And how did that develop? So you were then going into seeing these native plants and then just started getting interested in the plants themselves?
Yes, well, being very interested in nature, and I spent my as many waking hours of my childhood out of doors, wandering the woods and streams and whatnot, interacting with and collecting animals and snakes and frogs and fish and then later insects. And it all, it was interesting. Everything wild would eventually come around to plants, because plants, of course, power the planet and feed all the life on the planet. So I guess my interest just evolved. Well, I'm still very interested in animals and fish. I still have aquariums, but that for some reason really plants really intrigued me and clicked in my brain and pursued plants as a teen, and then went to college to get a degree in horticulture and just never looked back.
So how did that eventually develop into High Country Gardens?
Well, I got my degree in horticultural science from Colorado State, and at first, I wasn't sure if I wanted to go into botany or certain parts of horticulture. And finally, it dawned on me that what I really enjoyed doing was growing plants. And, of course, to grow plants, a greenhouse is an important part of being able to grow things year-round and get things off to an early start and grow your own seedlings. So my interest evolved into greenhouse production. So I started my I call it the mothership, Santa Fe Greenhouses here in Santa Fe, back in 1984. And then as an effort to diversify our market outside of little sunny Santa Fe, we got into the mail order plant business in 1993. And that gave me an opportunity to grow and sell plants to a much wider audience, and it also allowed me to grow more esoteric material because I had a bigger market of people that would be interested in buying unusual plants.
So what is it that excites you about native and drought-tolerant plants? Why do you keep doing it?
Well, certainly their beauty is first and foremost. I'm like a human butterfly. I love color. I thrive on having a brightly lit up garden with lots of different colorful plants. And here in New Mexico, in our arid, very challenging gardening climate, native plants, of course, are all around me here in the plains and mountains, and provide a very welcome addition to the garden in terms of not only their color and attractiveness as habitat for pollinators, but also their relative ease of maintenance and their water-wise nature, which in high, dry Santa Fe is a real plus.
Do you know, the one comment I get most is I'm surprised at how colorful and how nice a native and drought-tolerant bed can look when it's done right. I think most people still think of cactus or looking grassy or dry when it doesn't have to be that way.
Well, that's very true, Brian. I think a lot of people, when they think about water-wise gardening, they figure that, well, you know, it's some gravel and a scraggly yucca in the front yard, and they call it a day. And in the vernacular, water-wise gardening is also referred to as xeriscaping, X-E-R-I, scaping. Dryscaping is literally what it means. But unfortunately, a lot of people have uninformed view about xeriscaping and consider it zeroscaping, as in Z-E-R-O, and then proceed to do exactly that. Basically, get rid of their landscape and replace it with gravel. And that, unfortunately, has stuck in people's minds when they think about water-wise landscaping. And much to their surprise and delight, when they see it done properly, they realize, oh my gosh, this is just as pretty as traditional gardening techniques, and quickly become converts to a more water-wise outlook on gardening.
And it's not just color at one time of the year. You can plan it to have color continually throughout the growing season.
Absolutely. Well, here in New Mexico, we are on the north end of the Chihuahuan Desert, which is a huge desert extending across much of southern New Mexico, West Texas, and much of northeastern and north central Mexico. So it is an extremely large and diverse desert environment. And part of the Chihuahuan Desert's ecology are summer rains. We call them the monsoons, where water is brought up. Water vapor either comes up from the Gulf of Mexico or the Gulf of California in July and August, and provides much of our annual precipitation at that time of the year, which in turn brings a lot of these Chihuahuan desert species into bloom in late summer and early fall. So by, for example, integrating these wonderful Chihuahuan desert natives into the water-wise garden, spring is always an easy time to color up the garden, but these Chihuahuan desert natives color up the late summer and fall garden and really give you, gosh, a growing season full of interesting and colorful plants.
Do some of those Chihuahuan desert natives transfer to, say, northern Utah? In other words, we don't have much rain at all in the summer, but we've got the colder winters.
Yes, well, they respond to irrigation, and they naturally bloom. Many of the species naturally bloom in late summer and early fall. And when you take them out of New Mexico or West Texas, they have surprising cold hardiness, which allows them to be used in Salt Lake City and colder areas of the Intermountain West.
Well, I want to talk to Jeanette. Jeanette Warner is owner of Wildland Nursery. And Joseph, Utah in the Sevier County. So, Jeanette, you've been growing natives in Utah. What do you find as far as penstemons? How well do they do in other native plants taken from other states and brought into Utah as far as their transferring of and being able to grow them here?
That's a real good question. I think the Intermountain West area and the Great Plains is a good resource for native plants. I know that that we have some of the native plants that have kind of migrated from the plains, and I think that they do really well here, mingled in with the penstemons. I really think that the penstemons that we have here are outstanding for our local gardens.
So which ones would you both recommend for someone who's just getting into growing native and drought-tolerant plants, and maybe amending the soil may not be something that they want to do too much? So if you've got a soil with a little bit of clay but it still drains okay, what would you recommend starting out with for success? And Jeanette, we'll start with you.
Yeah, the first one that I would recommend for the beginner is the Rocky Mountain penstemon, Penstemon strictus. I think it is the absolutely best, easiest, prettiest blooming purple, dark blue purple flower that there is. And I have heavy, heavy clay soil where I am, and they just go crazy.
And do they continue to increase in size each year, or do they, you know, last 3 to 5 years and then you have to replant?
Oh, I think that they increase in size and they spread to other parts of the garden. I think they're quite delightful that way. And then, you know, when they finish blooming, you can cut those stalks off, and the basal leaves make a really nice green ground cover also.
Okay. And David, what are your recommendations?
Well, you can't go wrong with Penstemon strictus. It's definitely one of the most widely grown and adaptable of our showy penstemon. I also like the pine leaf penstemon, Penstemon pinnifolius. There are numerous versions of the plant in terms of size and flower color. I also enjoy Penstemon palmeri is a great big grower with one of the few fragrant penstemon, and I like Penstemon eatoni, the firecracker penstemon, because it's one of our earliest large growing penstemon, and really, as the common name would suggest, is a wonderfully vibrant scarlet flower. So those are a couple of additions to Penstemon strictus that I think are nice addition or are nice varieties for people to cut their teeth on, so to speak.
I'm looking through my edition of Waterwise Native Plants for Intermountain Landscapes, and I haven't started to grow them yet, but I'm looking at the Whipple penstemon, and it's got quite a nice color to it. How well do they grow in more clay soils?
I think that they'll do okay. I have them in my yard, and I do like them, but mine are, you know, I do have berms in my yard, and so, you know, building a berm helps to provide drainage, and so they do okay.
I've noticed that some of these do tend to be susceptible to root rot, so they don't like the extra water.
Right, or amended soil, and usually I tell my customers if they're amending the soil that they're planting the wrong plants. Because, you know, in the native plants here, they're adapted to our soil. And it might be a little bit heavy clay, but I've noticed in David's catalog lately, he says dry clay, and that makes the difference right there, that the plant will do well in dry clay.
So are there some of these then that, and I'm assuming maybe most of them, that you could put in a landscape without any extra supplemental watering other than just to get them established?
Yeah, oh, I think so, yes, uh-huh. Maybe, you know, some of them you want a little bit longer bloom, and a little bit of water will prolong the bloom. The firecracker in my yard has been blooming for almost 2 months this spring, and it's just been spectacular.
Is that because of the drier spring that we've had?
Well, you know, I tend to understand it. I water the yard like once every 3 weeks, and they haven't had any more water than that, and they are just incredible.
Well, and there's the other another attractiveness for penstemons are the way that they attract insects and birds, hummingbirds. I've seen a hummingbird around my firecracker penstemon pretty much just about every day, and then the native bees just go crazy over it.
That's the number one reason I would plant penstemons, is for the pollinators.
Now, David, in your experience, what penstemons are there that bring you color in the fall, or at least late summer?
Well, in general, Brian, the penstemon are at their peak color in, I'd say, mid-spring through June. But there are a few species that I'm familiar with from New Mexico that bloom into July and possibly August. And one of my favorites in that late blooming time slot would be the cardinal penstemon, or penstemon cardinalis. It's a rather narrowly distributed variety from south central New Mexico, but it has very attractive, very tall, full spikes of deep red tubular flowers that are a particular favorite with the hummingbird population. At least all the hummingbirds around New Mexico really enjoy them, but they will anywhere because they're nectar rich. Penstemon's pinnifolia, certain selections of that species also bloom in mid summer, July, possibly extending a little bit in August. But a lot of the penstemons are load up the garden earlier in the season with their colorful flowers.
Now, can you deadhead them and possibly get another flush of color, or do they not do that?
Well, a lot of the wild penstemon really don't rebloom, but there are some very good hybrid varieties, hardy hybrid varieties, that you can coax into rebloom from deadheading.
So I was just thinking of there's a certain penstemon that you see in the stores all the time, and now that the name is gone, it's like a red.
Yes, it's penstemon Mexicali Red Rocks.
Yes, so you see Red Rocks all the time. Then there's one that has a white flower. Are these usually hybrids that you see in most stores?
I would say generally they are propagated from cuttings rather than seed. And in the ornamental flower industry, many growers prefer to propagate plants from cuttings because they're more reliable than seed. Because sometimes penstemons can be a little tricky to grow from seed on a very consistent basis, because seed availability and seed quality does vary from year to year.
Okay. Well, we've reached the halfway point of our program already. I still wanted to talk about exactly how to plant a penstemon and what to look for. We've got online with us from Santa Fe, New Mexico, David Salmon, who's owner of High Country Gardens, and also Jeanette Warner, owner of Wildland Nursery in Joseph, Utah. And right now we're going to hear the latest edition of Wild About Utah, but stay tuned because we'll have them through the top of the hour.
Add a little magic to your landscape with a fairy garden. Hi, I'm Melinda Myers, horticulturist and gardening expert. These miniature gardens can be tucked under the shade of trees and shrubs, built on a bird bath or stump, or planted in any size container. Just be sure to shelter your miniature garden from harsh weather, flooded soils, and wandering feet. Start with a focal point. It can be a purchased or homemade home for fairies, a small-scale bench, miniature trees, pond, or a plant-covered arbor. Use young dwarf evergreens, bonsai plants, or prune bay, rosemary, or any small-leaved plant to look like a tree. Train wire vine over a miniature arbor, and use woolly thyme, baby tears, Irish moss, and creeping speedwell for ground covers. Succulents and other small plants make nice accents. Accessorize with found or purchased items. Fill a small plant saucer with water for a pond, use a thimble for container, and add some small-scale furniture. Check out our website for this and other gardening tips.
Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches. Welcome back to Access Utah. What we just heard was Melinda's gardening moment, so we'll still have our Wild About Utah segment that will be coming up later in the half an hour. We've got David Salmon, who's owner of High Country Gardens in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and Jeanette Warner, owner of Wildland Nursery in Joseph, Utah, on the line with us. We've been talking about penstemons, and if you'd like to join our conversation, the toll-free number is 1-800-826-
Okay. 1495.
That's 800-826-1495. Or you can go to our website, upr.org, and be able to find information out about the Utah Native Plant Society and the Penstemon Festival, which will be coming up this Friday and Saturday. Again, that's at upr.org. Okay, so talking about the festival here, will there be more than just about penstemons? I'm assuming you'll have more information about native and drought-tolerant plants, Jeanette.
Yes, we have some other really good speakers coming. Dr. Stephen Love from the University of Idaho will talk about his research in the penstemons, developing new cultivars, new varieties. And then Heidi Kratch, she's a horticultural specialist from the University of Nevada. She has written a book on water-efficient landscaping in the Intermountain West, and that should be very interesting to hear. Then we've got some other speakers talking about your how to xeriscape, xeriscaping 101. So we do have, it's all basically about natives, but gardening, water-wise gardening, xeriscaping, and plant selection.
So how do you get started? I mean, I think that's the most daunting thing that people think about is, well, I've got to dig up everything in my yard and do something completely different than I already have. Now I keep threatening to kill all the grass in my front yard because the only time I'm on it is when I'm when the lawn's getting mowed. So yeah, I do kind of want to do some big changes there. But how can the average person just get started and be successful? Because I think that's the most important thing. If you're not successful initially, then it kind of, you get discouraged later on.
It is. I think it is kind of a daunting idea. For one thing, you can start in one part of your yard. I find that my customers will come with, I've got this hot, dry problem area. What do I do? And they can start there, and if that part is successful, then they will gradually work into the rest of their garden.
Well, and I know for myself, it was just starting a little bit at a time, and instead of trying to do a whole lot at once. If I could find just a couple of plants to get started, then we're okay. I know for me, now that I've to the point where I've gotten a bed established, now I'm kind of branching out and trying to do something a little bit different. I haven't been successful at getting buffalo berry to grow in this area, but I'll probably keep trying it. But that's the fun part, is the experimentation. And David, as you're out and about and looking for plants, what do you like to experiment with? What's your favorite thing to do?
Certainly plants from when I'm out, New Mexico is a, like Utah, has a wonderful variety of biomes or I guess ecotypes, different types of environments where plants and animals live. And the eastern part of the state includes the edge of the Great Plains. So I like to go out and look at native plants on the Great Plains to bring back into cultivation because they are so adaptable to crazy weather conditions. They're very tolerant to heat, they're tolerant to cold, and are often, more times than not, very growable in a more domestic situation.
Do most drought-tolerant plants typically need to have any extra fertilization once they've been planted and established?
Well, I like to feed them modestly in the fall. And just to clarify that a little bit, the important thing about quote-unquote feeding plants is that we in organic gardening, and I'm a huge advocate of gardening organically, the soil is, of course, the foundation of any successful organic garden. So we're actually feeding the soil to maintain a healthy underground ecology, and a healthy soil grows healthy plants. So I like to feed the soil in the fall, but I do it lightly around my native plants because I never use chemical fertilizers like Miracle-Gro, and a lot of the very strong chemical fertilizers are bad news for many of our wildflowers. And on the topic of penstemons really don't like strong chemical fertilizers in the garden. So fertilizing is important in that it does help you maintain a healthy living soil, and that healthy living soil makes nutrients available to the plants.
So what are you putting into the soil? So you're not using chemicals, which, and I'm a good advocate of that as well, being more organic in gardening. What do you do to keep the profile of the nutrients in the soil to a point where it should remain?
Well, I use a combination of my favorite natural fertilizer is called Yum Yum Mix. And it's a wonderful blend of alfalfa meal, cottonseed meal, kelp meal, soft rock phosphate, trace mineral fertilizer, and some humates. So it's a very beneficial mix to feeding the soil. And the other thing that I find native plants really enjoy are, in organic gardening circles, it's often referred to as rock dust. Or specifically, there are brands of rock dust that provide, when you grind up certain rock deposits that are unusually rich in a lot of micronutrients and other trace elements, many of our native plants benefit greatly, not so much from nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium, the big three that are common in chemical fertilizers, but really thrive on these trace mineral fertilizers. So I'm a big believer of remineralizing your soil periodically with rock dust.
Now, with a regular vegetable garden, I will plant cover crops and then till those crops in to help replenish the soil. You can't really do that with a native flower bed because you don't want to disturb the root zones.
Well, and in fact, a lot of the newer techniques that are being developed for vegetable gardening are very cautious about continually going out and tilling up the garden every spring, and are encouraging people to really do a more no-till or no-dig style of gardening, where you really only excavate or turn the soil where directly in the planting hole. And instead, after that initial rototilling to get new soil conditioned and add organic materials and whatnot so that they can get deeply down into the soil, that you feed the soil from the top and leave the newly formed soil profile undisturbed.
So you're just feeding around the plant itself?
Well, you're actually just throwing fertilizer all over the top of the soil. And then the critters down in the soil's ecosystem, everything from the earthworms to bacteria and beneficial fungi, and then there are lots of very small arthropods and other insects, they come to the top of the soil and pull those nutrients down into the soil where they chew on it, and then after it's digested, it's in form available to plant roots to absorb.
Now, when it comes to penstemons, are they prone to diseases, or are they like most plants? Some may be more so than others.
Well, penstemons are susceptible to diseases, but a lot of diseases come from improper cultural techniques. Folks are not necessarily real familiar with a lot of these arid land native plants, and so they use bark mulch or composted leaves or very rich, moisture-retentive mulches. And for penstemons, that's a no-no. They do not like to have their crowns in contact with bark mulch or rich compost, because that invariably will lead to a shorter-lived and more disease-prone plant.
Do they typically, penstemons, reseed on their own when you leave the ground open?
Yes, or if you want to encourage penstemons to reseed, mulch with gravel mulch. That is an incredible mulch for encouraging native plants such as penstemon to reseed readily.
So they like having it. The mulch is still retaining moisture in the soil. So how is that? It's just less organic? Is that why they like it?
Well, gravel seems to provide a little more sheltered position for the seeds. They'll get pushed down to the surface of the soil underneath the gravel, and it seems to provide an ideal germinating environment for many of our native plants, and penstemons in general reseed readily and quite happily into gravel mulch.
Okay. What I want to talk about here for about the next 5 to 7 minutes are, for the both of you, what are your favorite native plants, and what do you think would grow well in Utah? Now, again, we have such varied soils, and we're talking to people who go from live in St. George, even down in Mesquite, Nevada, all the way up to Desoto Springs, Idaho. But what native plants generally will do well in a Utah climate? Now, one that I've discovered, and it is fast becoming one of my favorite, are hyssop, hummingbird mint. And I love the plant. I love how it brings color into the fall, and there's just so many varied colors with it.
So, yeah, I agree. I like the hyssop a lot, too, the agastache or agastache, however you want to say it. And they are great for fall blooming. For a fall blooming garden. And just to mention, my favorite fall blooming penstemon is Penstemon barbatus. It's just spectacular here in my garden. It has the bright red tubular flowers like the firecracker does in the spring, but it's like 4 to 5 feet tall. And when the hummingbirds are migrating south for the winter, it kind of gives them an extra little meal on the way.
So they know to stop off in Joseph, Utah for a little bit extra.
Yeah, they do, regularly.
And David, for you?
Well, just to add to Jeanette's comment about hummingbirds, they are extremely intelligent little birds. And in their migratory routes, if they know that your garden is loaded up with nectar-bearing plants, they will remember it, and the same little birds will come back to your garden for at least 2 or 3 years, or as long as they're alive, they'll stop by. In terms of other native plants, I think it's very important to remember a lot of the native ornamental grasses. It's a very important category, particularly for late season interest, late summer and fall and winter interest. Things like little bluestem, blue grama, panicum, which is also known as prairie switchgrass. So the native ornamental grasses are a very important part of our native plant palette. I like, if you're not plagued by rabbits, I love calorow. Poppy mallow is a wonderful spreading ground cover-like plant that works well with beard tongues. I like Zinnia grandiflora, very late blooming. Well, that's not true. It blooms several times a year. It blooms in late spring and then comes back into color in late summer, and that's actually a true perennial zinnia. People think of the big flashy annuals, the cut-and-come-again types, but this is actually a native to the prairies of the Great Plains, and it is gosh, I've got zinnia grandiflora in my garden that have been there for 25 years.
One of your specialties, I've noticed, is that, is it pronounced agastache?
Yes, you can pronounce it agastache, agastache, agastache.
Okay.
A lot of ways to pronounce it, but if you come into any nursery that's familiar with native plants, we'll know what you're talking about. But yes, that's one of my specialties. I've been fascinated by that genus for, going on about 20 years now. And a fine example of Chihuahuan desert natives that are very adaptable to both culture in the Great Plains and the Intermountain West. Agastache rupestris, the licorice mint hyssop, is probably the one that I would recommend folks start with first. It's the Penstemon strictus equivalent of the hummingbird mints, very growable and widely adaptable.
I was going to say, they seem to be a little more adaptable to at least the soils here in northern Utah. In general, the agastache that I have, they just keep coming back. They don't like it getting too cold, and we had a weather incident here a year and a half ago where it was nice and warm and then dropped to below zero in November that just took out, I almost took out the ones that I have, and they started off again in the spring, very tiny, but they did come back.
Well, particularly the licorice mint hyssop, the Agastache rupestris, is a willing reseeder. So if you put it into a situation that has gravel mulch, you will find your garden populated by many colorful little volunteer plants over the years as well.
How many different varieties of agastache are there?
There's roughly 15 species, and again, they're a North American genus with only one genus coming to us from Asia. And the southwestern agastache are by far the showiest. There are some species from the Midwest, but they aren't. They're very nice and growable and bring the blue color to the genus, but our southwestern varieties are by far the most colorful and largely flowered.
Now, I know that the ones that I have growing is probably the ones I get the most comment on. They're really small flowers, but again, the insects really enjoy them, and that's one of the major reasons why I like to grow native plants.
Well, that genus is a pollinator's daydream because they attract bees, butterflies, hummingbirds. The smaller flowered varieties are particularly valuable to the bees, both native and honeybees, and the larger flowered varieties are definitely favorites of the hummingbirds.
Now, as far as color, is that the difference with if you get more bees versus hummingbirds? How do plants, how are they adapted? Why do they have the different colors?
The flower size has more to do with the pollinators selecting a given plant. The hummingbirds don't like little tiny tubular flowers because it takes too much effort to hover and sip the nectar from what they derive from the plant. So they like the bigger flowers, but the smaller flowered hummingbird mints are extremely popular with the bees because they're very nectar rich, but the bees don't have to hover. They literally crawl across the flower to sip the nectar.
I noticed when I was working in my yard on Saturday, and I was planting some strawberries, and I heard a lot of buzzing above my head and looked up in my poppy, which is, of course, not necessarily a native to Utah, and the bees couldn't get out. They were stuck inside the flower itself, they had so much, they were so laden with pollen that they just couldn't find their way back out again, or kept sliding around inside the cup.
Well, that's an abundant flower garden.
So you wouldn't have that with the natives necessarily so much. Now, one of the things that I wanted to talk about are some of the general soil conditions for native and drought tolerant plants. When you're putting a plant in, generally then a mulch is not a good thing, or just the type of mulch makes the difference?
Well, the type of mulch is the key. You know, not all natives are dry land plants. Not all natives like the blazing sun. Columbine are an excellent example of a wildflower that appreciates a more amended soil, a moister soil, and appreciates a mulch material that breaks down and enriches the soil. Many other plants, native plants that do like the hot, dry conditions, they really prefer gravel is probably my first pick, but if you're not in a fire-prone area, pine needles are an excellent native plant mulch.
And why is that? Just because they are not too dense when you're putting them down?
Yes, they're not too dense, and they don't have a lot of organic material in terms of when they break down. They very gradually enrich the soil, but as opposed to leaves in a deciduous forest, which build in time quite a layer of rich humusy topsoil. The pine needles provide lots of air and water permeability and penetration without packing down.
Do they tend to acidify the soil at all?
Not in any amount that makes a difference. Our western soils are alkaline, and much of our irrigation water is alkaline. So what little acidity comes from the pine needles is actually a good thing, not detrimental.
Okay, so could you use those around your penstemons?
Absolutely.
Sounds good. All right, so Jeanette, in the last couple of minutes that we have, I wanted you to talk about what else that people can expect from the Penstemon Festival this Friday and Saturday. It's at the Sevier County Fairgrounds, which is at 400 East and 200 South in Richfield. This is the fourth festival that you've had. So why don't you talk a little bit about the schedule?
Okay. On Friday, June 8th, from 1 until 5, we'll have a native plant sale. And it will probably be the best native plant sale. A lot of growers, the local growers here, will have plants there. Lots of penstemons for sale, of course. Gardener's Market, and there'll be some garden art, some penstemon seeds, some books. We're having a book sale, postcards, and that kind of stuff. Just kind of a little small get-together there. And then from 1 until 5 also will be our guest speakers. At 6 o'clock that evening, on Friday evening, will be our social hour, which will be refreshments and a chance to mingle, talk to David and the other speakers. And at 7 o'clock will be our keynote speaker, and that's David Salmon from High Country Gardens. And the title of our festival is kind of like dispelling the native plant myth, because like David said earlier, people think that a native plant garden consists solely of cactus and yucca. And I think his High Country Gardens is a prime example that native plant gardens isn't that way at all. And then on Saturday morning, we'll have garden tours, some of the nicer gardens around the county will be available to go visit. And also we'll have some hikes just around the hillsides here to see some of our wildflowers and hopefully penstemons, even though it's a very, very dry year this year. Some of the wildflowers are in short supply.
Well, this sounds like a great weekend. I probably should take a drive down there just for the sale itself. Thank you both of you for joining us on the program today.
Well, thank you, Brian.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Access Utah. We've had with us online from Santa Fe, New Mexico, David Salmon, owner of High Country Gardens, and from Joseph, Utah in Sevier County, Jeanette Warner of Wildland Nursery. Coming up right now is the latest edition of Wild About Utah, and stay tuned again next week when we'll have another gardening topic. Diane Alston, USU Extension entomologist, will be our guest then. Thanks for joining us.
Welcome to Wild About Utah, a partnership of the Stokes Nature Center, the Bridgerland Audubon Society, and Utah Public Radio.
This is Linda Kirvin for Bridgerland Audubon Society. Mention boas and we imagine steaming South American rainforests, home to emerald tree boas and enormous boa constrictors. However, the canyons of northern Utah are home to the rubber boa, one of only two native North American boas. Rubber boas range from northern Utah west to the Pacific coast and north to Vancouver. The adult resembles a thin kielbasa sausage in size and shape, having both a blunt tail and head. Juveniles are the size of a crayon. A rubber boa's leathery skin is the color of creamy coffee, its scales giving it a rubbery texture. Like other boas, it has vestigial hind legs called spurs, with which males stimulate females during mating. Rubber boas are active at night during the summer. In spring, they can be among the first snakes to come out from the talus slopes and rock crevices where they hibernate. In Cache County, they can be found basking from March through November. From April to August, pregnant females use these rocky habitats to maintain body temperatures around 88 degrees. When not pregnant, rubber boas stay remarkably cool for a snake, around 57 degrees. In late summer, females bear an average of 4 live young. They only reproduce every 2 to 3 years, so juvenile survival must be quite high. In captivity, rubber boas can live 30 years or more. It's hard to imagine these docile, slow-moving snakes as predators, but rubber boas eat mammals, birds, reptiles, and eggs. Like other boas, they have no venom and kill by constriction, often consuming whole litters of nestling mice, voles, pocket gophers, shrews, and moles. The snakes fend off the protective rodent parents with their short, blunt tails, which often bear bite scars. Both rubber boas and rodents evolved in Asia about 45 million years ago, which suggests that they have been predator and prey for a very long time. Thanks to Andrew Durso, Utah State herpetology student, for today's essay. This is Linda Kirvin for Bridgerland Audubon Society.
Wild About Utah is a partnership of the Stokes Nature Center, the Bridgerland Audubon Society, and Utah Public Radio. For transcripts and archived audio of Wild About Utah, go online to upr.org and click on the Wild About Utah link. Support for Wild About Utah comes from the College of Natural Resources at Utah State University. Information is at cnr.usu.edu.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.